Hello, my name is Colin Daniels. I'm the Working Age and Young People Service Manager for the Macular Society. Now, as you might know, the Macular Society hosts two live webinars each month focusing on all aspects of living with macular disease. We speak to leading experts, clinicians, and researchers about the latest in macular disease. The first of the webinars focuses very much on age-related macular degeneration, and the second on areas for people of a working age and a bit younger. Now, we understand that not everyone has the opportunity to watch our webinars, so we have decided to turn some of the content into podcasts. The podcasts will be available on all good podcast platforms. So here we go. Welcome to the Macular Society Macular and Me series again. So here we are, and we're here with Samantha Mann from St. Thomas's. Who's going to talk about diabetic eye disease. But for those of you who don't know me, just to start off with, my name is Colin Daniels, and I'm the Macular Society Working Age and Young People Service Manager. And I've been with the Society for just like an age now. I think it's cruising on for 9 years almost. We started these, you know, as a way of keeping patient information moving around when we're all locked down in our homes. And here we are. So it's fantastic. So anyway, as usual, we have a speaker and who's going to talk about the subject for a wee while, and then the chat will be open. Samantha's very kindly talked before for us in our annual conference a couple of years ago, and that also went down very well, so we thought we'd invite her back. So good evening, Samantha. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm fine, thank you.
Jolly good. Excellent. All right. Well, I mean, people hear enough from me, so why don't you give us a talk then, and we'll all sit back and listen.
So my name is Samantha Mann. I work as a consultant ophthalmologist at St. Thomas's Hospital. I'm also the screening lead for our diabetic eye screening program in Southeast London. And I'm going to be talking to you today about diabetes in your eyes, current and future treatments. So I apologise for any of you who have heard me talk before you, but I'll try and keep the content as up to date as possible, a bit more interesting as well. So as you know, diabetes causes many complications. These can be microvascular and macrovascular changes. The macrovascular changes can lead to an increased risk of stroke and heart attack. And the microvascular changes tend to involve the organs of the body, including the kidneys, the feet, and the eyes. And particularly in the eyes, you know, it causes retinopathy at the back of the eye, which is what I'm going to be concentrating on today. But it can increase the risk of cataract, which comes on a bit earlier, and can also increase the risk of glaucoma in some circumstances. I'm sure a lot of you have heard a lot in the press about prevention of diabetes. It seems to be quite an important topic at the moment in type 2, and it's more to do with putting type 2 diabetes in remission or trying to reverse type 2 diabetes. And a lot of this is based on work from Professor Roy Taylor from Newcastle and his DIRECT trial. He's also written a book about life without diabetes. And it's predominantly looking at ways of trying to put diabetes in remission. He believes very strongly that patients with diabetes have, from his research, has been shown that there's an excess of fat inside the liver and inside the pancreas. And by limiting the diet, particularly, I mean, it's quite a tall ask, I think, to expect people to be on a diet of 800 calories a day. But he's shown that being on this diet can, you know, reduce the amount of fat increase inside the liver and the pancreas, and can put type 2 diabetes in remission. But having said this, a lot of work is going on at the moment about this, and there's a lot of books around, including Professor Taylor's book, trying to get patients more interested to try to put their diabetes in remission, and that can, I mean, can certainly can help to reduce risks of retinopathy as well. But what we're talking about mainly is today is about the way that diabetes does affect the eye. And we know that 5 million people now are living with diabetes in the UK, and this is predicted to increase to about 5.5 million by 2030. We know that there are two main types of diabetes. There's a type 1, where you can't make your own insulin at all, and this corresponds to about 8% of the diabetes population. And then there's type 2, which is about 90%, when the insulin you produce is less effective or you can't produce enough of it. We know that from studies that in patients with type 1 diabetes, about 1 in 2 will have some level of retinopathy at some point, and in type 2 diabetes, about 1 in 3 will have some levels of retinopathy. Now, do remember that most of these levels of retinopathy are not serious or sight-threatening, and many of these treatment forms can be treated now. There are also rarer forms of diabetes, or can be steroid-induced or gestational, and other types as well, that make up about 2% of the population. And just a note of gestational diabetes can occur in pregnancy, but this does not require any eye screening as it does not cause any retinopathy. So diabetic retinopathy, one of the good things that has happened over the last few years is no longer the leading cause of blindness in the working age population. And the main factors behind this have been mainly the diabetic eye screening program and the success of that, and also improved blood sugar control with better treatments on the market as well. And we have better treatments in the eye clinic. Remember that most patients with diabetes have, or most people with diabetes have non-sight-threatening levels of retinopathy, and it's only a small proportion that develop the sight-threatening type. It is still, however, a cause of visual problems if left untreated or if it's progressive at the back of the eye. So just moving on to say, how is the eye affected by diabetes? We tend to divide it up into two different stages. There's the retinopathy part, which is really what we look for around the edge of the retina, the back of the eye. And then there's the maculopathy, which is the central part of the back of the eye. The retinopathy is predominantly based to due to changes of the blood vessels at the back of the eye and reduced blood flow, and what we call ischemia, because the blood flow is reduced at the back of the eye. Which causes a chemical called vascular endothelial growth factor. Well, a number of factors are released, but particularly the VEGF is released at the back of the eye, which results in hemorrhaging, cotton wool spots, we call them, at the back of the eye, and new blood vessels or abnormal blood vessels to grow on the retina. And this can certainly cause problems with bleeding. And then the second thing we look for is what we call maculopathy. And this is really when we see blood vessels that form little outpouchings of the blood vessel walls, outpouching called a microaneurysm. And that can result in leakage of fluid into the retina and in the central area called maculopathy. And that leakage tends to show itself with these little yellow deposits around an area of leakage. And we call those exudates. And they can show us that there is some maculopathy occurring in the retina. Both of these can be treated. And I'll be talking more about that shortly. The problem with diabetic retinopathy is that it is a progressive condition, and unfortunately you don't get any symptoms from the retinopathy until very late stages. So people with diabetes can have quite extensive changes at the back of the eye right the way through to quite advanced what we call proliferation of new blood vessels at the back of the eye, or R3 in our language, and you can have no symptoms at all. And then it's only if some of these abnormal blood vessels will then bleed into the back of the eye, bleed into the gel, and cause a vitreous hemorrhage. And that's when it would cause symptoms of blurring of vision. So the problem with diabetes is that it can, you know, be quite significant changes at the back of the eye. No, you wouldn't know about it unless you had your diabetic eye screening check or eye check in the clinic, and then it could be diagnosed. And then the late stages obviously can lead to visual problems, blurring, and visual loss if there's a large bleed into the back of the eye. What about the maculopathy we mentioned? So the maculopathy can also be asymptomatic or no symptoms in the early stages, but it can also cause visual blurring once it gets more central at the back of the eye. And it can occur any stage of the retinopathy. So if you have early retinopathy, you can have maculopathy. And if you have late stage retinopathy, you could also have maculopathy. How else do we assess the eye in the clinic? Well, we tend to use a scanner. It's called an OCT scan. Many of you might have had a scan before, or if anyone comes to the eye clinic regularly, may have had a scan before. It's a very straightforward thing to have done. It's a bit like a photograph at the back of the eye, and it shows us exactly where the swelling is at the back of the eye in what we call maculopathy. And this OCT scan shows quite nicely the red patch there, just off to the center, that's the center of the back of the eye, the fovea, and just off to the side there's an area of swelling here, and that's what we call diabetic maculopathy. And that, you know, although it wouldn't necessarily cause a problem with the vision, it could potentially cause problems with the vision if it were to spread into the center. So we would often want to treat this area of swelling, and it's nicely shown up on the OCT scan for us to be able to treat it. So we talked about the nature of diabetic retinopathy. The problem is you don't get symptoms until quite late in the disease process. And that's why diabetic eye screening is so important. An annual eye screen in your diabetic eye screening program, or if you're under the eye clinic, you know, to check the changes is very important. And then if they do notice any changes on the retinal photographs, then you'll be referred to the hospital eye service for treatment, so that we can carry it out before there's the risk of any sight loss. Eye screening is different to your local optometry check or optometrist check, because the optometrist will look for the general health of the eye, will check for conditions like glaucoma or high pressure in the eye, will also check for glasses, can also check for macular degeneration and things like that, but they won't necessarily be trained in how to recognize all the different features in diabetes. Whereas if you have your diabetic eye screening checked in, then the team looking at your photographs will be trained specifically to look for diabetic changes and will be able to refer you if you need to be seen in the eye clinic. I've talked before, I know, about risk factors for progression, but they haven't changed very much. They still seem to be pretty much the same. There's what we call the non-modifiable risk factors. The type of diabetes you have, the duration of diabetes is very important, age and ethnicity. And then there's the modifiable ones, glucose control, blood pressure control, lipid or cholesterol levels, pregnancy and non-attendance I put on there as well, which is quite important. When we look at age, we know that diabetic retinopathy tends to affect younger patients more than the older patients. And it tends to be, you know, the ones that need, this is a graph showing the number of patients that need routine and urgent referrals to the hospital ISO. This is from our screening program. And you can see that the highest bars are in the lower age groups, the 20 to 24, 25 to 29, 30 to 34, 35 to 39. So these are the ones that need the highest amount of referrals into the eye service. And that's the routine referrals, the green bars. And then the dark sort of black bars are the urgent referrals to the eye clinic from the diabetic eye screening program. And again, you can see it's the younger age group, 25 to 29, the 30 to 34 and 35 to 39s that need to, and the 40s. That need the more referrals for urgent pathology. So it does tend to, you know, cause more problems in the younger patients rather than the older patients. Moving on to ethnicity, it is important to know that, you know, to note what the ethnicity is, because there is a difference. We certainly see up to three times more maculopathy requiring laser in the Afro-Caribbean group compared to Caucasian individuals, and with sight-threatening retinopathy, you're twice as likely to have sight-threatening retinopathy in the Afro-Caribbean population compared to Caucasian. And some of this might be genetic, and some of it might be relating to associated kidney disease, or it might be late presentation, or it could be a whole host of factors. We don't fully understand this yet. We know that glucose control is really important. We know that the higher the HbA1c, the risk of worsening of retinopathy is significant. This is an old study now, but the old study showed that you get a 75% reduction in developing retinopathy and a 50% reduction in progression of retinopathy by keeping the HbA1c lower than 4.7% or lower than 53 millimoles per mole. Having on the counter side to this, it's important not to bring the sugar down too quickly, because we know that if this HbA1c is brought down too quickly, that can cause a risk of worsening of retinopathy as well. But as long as it's managed appropriately and checked in the eye clinic, we can usually circumvent any problems there. Pregnancy, we know, can accelerate the course of diabetic retinopathy, especially type 1 patients. The most important factors seem to be the retinopathy levels at conception, and also the duration of diabetes prior to pregnancy. So we know that if women have progressed for more than 15 years of diabetes, then they're much more likely to progress during pregnancy. And we know that NICE recommends screening at least 2 to 3 times in your pregnancy. If you don't have any retinopathy, then you only need to be seen twice in pregnancy. But if you do have retinopathy, then you may need to be seen 3 times during your pregnancy. It is safe to put drops in if you're pregnant, and it's also safe to have laser treatment in pregnancy completely, where there's no risk at all, no side effects from on the pregnancy at all. But you can't have what we call injection treatments if you are pregnant, certainly not the anti-VEGF ones. They wouldn't be considered safe in that circumstance. So I mentioned non-attendance being an important factor. We did some research on our population in Southeast London about non-attendance, and we showed that people who missed 2 years of screening before they attended had a 10 times more risk, a higher risk of needing to be referred to the hospital than those that didn't miss 2 years of screening. So we know that missing screening appointments is important, is dangerous for the eyes. And this is an example of this graph shows us what the uptake is like against age. So how many people attend for their diabetic eye screening program according to their age group. And we can see from this that when patients are young, so between 12 and 15 years old, usually brought by their parents, the attendance is good, but it does drop off, usually sort of in the teens and early 20s, possibly when a lot of patients with diabetes have gone, moved to universities or moved away from home. It might be much more difficult when you're working, obviously, to attend these appointments. Life gets in the way. And then obviously, then the attendance does increase again from the 40s, 50s, 60s and goes up again. But it is difficult to get younger people to attend for appointments. But we know that, and that can be cause an increased risk of retinopathy if patients don't attend on a number of occasions. So what about treatments? We're talking about treatments now. I'll talk briefly about the Moonshot Project. I don't know much about that, but that is something I learned about recently at a recent conference in Hamburg. And then I'll talk about current used treatments for retinopathy, currently used treatments for maculopathy, and then potential new treatments as well. So the Moonshot Initiative has been led by the JDRF, and it's mainly about it's research looking at improving vision in diabetes. There isn't a lot of treatments at the moment that can improve vision significantly, although some of the anti-VEGF injections do that, but they're trying to basically, the reason why it's called a moonshot is because they're trying to achieve the impossible and trying to lead on a whole new set of research that will help to restore vision in people with diabetes. And that sounds quite exciting. And I think it's led by JDRF with Mary Tyler Moore's husband, Robert Levine, behind that. So that sounds quite exciting. I don't know a lot about it, but it is something that sounds quite exciting. So current treatment options for diabetic retinopathy, this is retinopathy I'm going to talk about now. This is when you get the new blood vessels growing on the retina and evidence of a reduction in the blood flow. So the main four treatments here I'm going to talk about: systemic control, laser treatment, anti-VEGF injection treatment, and vitrectomy surgery, which is much rarer to need that, but I'll talk briefly about that. Systemic controls, we know that the early stages of retinopathy are reversible if we can catch them early enough. But once you get to the advanced stages and the proliferative changes, then unfortunately it's very unlikely that these will reverse just with systemic control. But it certainly can help. And we know that good glucose control, blood pressure control is really important as well, because that can worsen retinopathy. And we'd always ask for it to be aim the blood pressure to be 130 over 80 or less. And we know the cholesterol can also reduce, controlling cholesterol can also reduce the risk of retinopathy progression. And that's from the field and the ACCORD studies. And so laser treatment is still very important in the treatment of what we call proliferative retinopathy, or R3 retinopathy. And that's when blood vessels start to grow on the retina in the wrong place. And these blood vessels tend to be very fragile, very delicate, and they grow on the surface of the retina and can bleed into the gel of the eye, causing loss of vision, can cause severe loss of vision. We know that pan-retinal laser, the PRP laser, can reduce this risk of severe vision loss by about 50% as opposed to untreated eyes. And we know that the greatest benefit is seen in those patients who have what we call the high-risk abnormal blood vessels, or the high-risk R3 or proliferative retinopathy. And that study was done for over 5 years. And we do the laser treatment to try to prevent bleeding of these abnormal blood vessels, which can cause bleeding if just left. The pan-retinal laser treatment, I know people don't like the idea of having laser treatment. It is a very effective treatment. It's a long-term treatment. It's a permanent treatment. I like to describe it as an insurance policy for the eye, to help the eye, protect the eye against problems in the future. And the trouble is, if you do the laser, if you catch the blood vessels early, then you can laser them and they respond much, much better. But if you leave the laser and you do the laser very late, once blood bleeding has occurred, it's much more difficult to laser at that stage, and the laser is less likely to work, and it's more likely that you're going to need a vitrectomy operation if you try to do the laser too late. Just talking a bit more about the laser, what does PRP laser involve? It's really treating the edge of the retina, the area of the retina that doesn't have a very good blood supply. We're treating that area. It's an outpatient appointment. We do a vision check, put dilating drops in, we numb the eye, we put a special lens on the eye to stop you blinking. The laser machine acts like a camera with a bright flash. It takes about 15, 20 minutes or so per eye sometimes. You might not need both eyes done at the same time. Sometimes it's just the one eye that needs lasering. And it's just, you do sometimes just get a slight twinge in the eye. Some people feel more discomfort than others with the pan-retinal laser, but it's usually once the treatment's done, after two or three treatments, usually that eye's been lasered, and it acts as an insurance policy to reduce the risk of further bleeding. But it can be, sometimes it does need to be repeated a few times. Moving on to anti-VEGF injections for R3. Now, this is the, again, this proliferative retinopathy I was telling you about. We don't use anti-VEGF injections currently for this proliferative retinopathy. It's not yet NICE approved. I know that there have been studies in America and the UK called the Clarity study and the Protocol S study. These studies have shown that the anti-VEGF injections can reduce the blood vessel growth and can reduce the sort of sight loss in the peripheral field vision, and they can, you know, reduce the need for surgery. But the problem with these treatments is that you need to keep going with the injections. You need to give the injections ongoing, you know, 1 to 3 monthly. It's a massive cost burden, treatment burden, regular treatments with possible increased risk of infections as well. And the trouble is, if you suddenly stop attending for these injection treatments, then you can do even worse, because you know, patients, there have been studies showing a worse outcome in people who've not continued with their injection treatment or have not attended for some reason. So it is potentially a treatment that maybe we may see more of in the future, but at the moment it's not recommended as a routine treatment for proliferative diabetic retinopathy. That's the R3. What about surgery, vitrectomy surgery? Now, we only use vitrectomy surgery in very advanced cases of diabetic retinopathy, when there's a lot of bleeding or fibrosis or scarring. And this is rare. This is sadly a patient, a 21-year-old patient of mine who had diabetes from the age of 2, had floaters and reduced vision. And she'd really, really struggled with her diabetes for several years, especially all through COVID. And she had quite a lot of bleeding and quite a lot of pulling and on the retina and scarring on the retina. She required vitrectomy surgery and laser, which really did help restore her sight. So although she was doing quite badly initially after COVID, she didn't have very good vision and had a lot of bleeding in the eyes. She actually recovered a lot of vision and is actually doing very well now. So the surgery actually worked really well for her. So moving on now to talk about maculopathy. We've talked a bit about the retinopathy, but this is maculopathy now. And we're just going to be talking a bit about this. There's 5 different main treatments that I'll be mentioning. So we mentioned about the systemic control, and that again is important. The early stages again are reversible with good control. Once the maculopathy is more extensive, it is harder to reverse. But there is a study called the Protocol V, which was a few years ago now, but talked about observation. So in early cases of maculopathy, when there's not much change in vision, when there's just a few little exudates around, it is actually quite safe to just wait and watch, not need to rush in with a laser and not need to rush in with injection treatment, because patients can do just as well observing them for 2 years. And you only need to start further treatments if the vision drops or if the maculopathy gets worse. But you can just observe patients in the early stages. What about the Cleopatra trial? Now, this was an interesting trial a few years ago, led by Shobha Sivaprasad, who's an amazing researcher in diabetes and, well, in general medical conditions. She's amazing, and she was to talk to in Hamburg as well recently. The Cleopatra trial was looking at light masks, wearing them at nighttime to reduce the risk of any maculopathy. Now, it's believed that patients in the nighttime, your retina is more metabolically active, and it was thought that that might lead to more oxygen demand at night, and it might be reason why people get maculopathy. And by wearing these special light masks, it was thought that you had to wear them all night. They were shining a bright light into the eye all night through the lids. And it was thought that might reduce the levels of maculopathy. But unfortunately, the trial didn't work, did not show any benefit from having this trial, these masks, and so it's been abandoned now. Still use focal laser treatment for maculopathy when it's not involving the centre of the back of the eye. So this is another example. You've seen this diagram again previously. There's an area of swelling away from the centre. So the centre of the grid is what we call the fovea. And this little area of swelling is just away from that. And that responds really well to laser treatment. And this is another patient who had laser treatment in a small area of swelling away from the centre, pre-laser and then post-laser, that settled down really nicely. So laser treatment can work very well if there's an area of swelling away from the center of the fovea. The laser treatment is done very much the same way as the other laser, the pan-retinal laser, but it's much quicker than the pan-retinal laser and much less uncomfortable. If we do move on now to the injection treatments, some patients do have injection treatments for macular degeneration and for other conditions, but we do use them in diabetes as well. And it's mainly when there's a lot of swelling at the back of the eye. So someone who has quite severe maculopathy, swelling in the centre part of the back of the eye, causing a reduction of vision. And that's when the injection treatment works the best. The macular area has to also be swollen to more than 400 microns to benefit, and that's when it's nice to recommend the treatment started. Again, it does involve monthly injection treatments. We use medications including ranibizumab, aflibercept, and there's a new one coming up called faricimab now, and that unfortunately, they do have to be given monthly initially, but then after a few months, usually what happens is the frequency goes down. But they do work very well at reversing the maculopathy and can also slow down the retinopathy as well. Anti-VEGF treatments, as I mentioned, the Eylea and Lucentis are the commonest ones we use, and they block the VEGF and they stop the leakage at the back of the eye. They also can block the abnormal blood vessels growing and can improve vision. But they do need to be given for quite significant amount of time, initially for the first 5 to 6 months, and then ongoing, maybe less frequently for a number of years. We also use steroids sometimes. There's a steroid injection called Ozodex or Ilevian. There's a longer lasting one. And these are anti-inflammatory. They can also help to improve vision. And we do use them in diabetes sometimes, but they can cause an increase in eye pressure and can cause cataract. Hence, we can only use them in patients who've had cataract surgery already. They do need to be given 3 to 4 monthly, and we tend to use them if patients are unresponsive to the anti-VEGF treatments, and then we would use the steroid Ozodex injections as well. Again, they can be given into the eye. The injection sounds awful, but most of our patients tolerate them extremely well, and they do keep coming back for more injections because they really work and they can improve the vision and they can reduce the amount of swelling at the back of the eye, and are very effective treatments. Unfortunately, these treatments do need to be repeated because they don't last that long in the eye. What does injection treatment involve? Again, it's an outpatient appointment. We check the vision, dilating drops, and we numb the eye. With drops, we use a special drape and a clip to stop the eye blinking, keep it all sterile. And it's a very quick injection into the eye with a bit of a pressure sensation, but it's not usually too painful. Although it sounds it, it's not actually that uncomfortable. And the eye often feels a bit gritty for about 24 hours afterwards. These do need to be repeated monthly for at least 4 to 6 months, and then less frequently after that. And they may need long-term treatment, just depending on how the response is. But you can reduce the amount of retinopathy by about 2 steps in the back of the eye by using these treatments as well. Vitrectomy surgery, again, is only used for very advanced cases. If there's a lot of pulling on the retina, then sometimes surgery can be beneficial. But we don't tend to use surgery very often for maculopathy in diabetes. So what about newer treatments? Just a quick whistle-stop tour for these. There are newer injection treatments. Faricimab, you might have heard of, a new drug called Vabysmo. Has the potential to last much longer than the current treatments. So instead of only being lasting 1 month or 2 months, it might actually last up to 4 months in between treatments. I'm going to talk a bit about the port delivery system, a little bit about gene therapy, and another study that's going on about diabetic eye drops for diabetic macular edema. The faricimab drug is very similar to the aflibercept, but it's actually has two arms. So the antibody, it's an antibody again, and it has two arms. One's what's called an anti-Ang2, and the other one is an anti-VEGF. They're just two molecules joined together, which seems to have a much stronger effect. And these two trials, Yosemite and Rhine trials, have just been shown the results recently to be very, very favourable. And it seems like patients can go up to 12 weeks or even up to 16 weeks between injections, much longer than we're getting at the moment with the aflibercept injections. The retina seems to be dried out much better with this faricimab. And although we don't have long-term data, we only have 2-year data at the moment, but it does seem to be a very safe drug to give and does seem to work much longer than the current treatment. So it's quite exciting, and we're due to start using these medications quite soon, because they're now NICE approved. What about the port delivery system? This is something you might have heard about. We haven't started using it much in the UK yet, although some centres might be using them. It's a little implant, a bit like a rice grain, that has to be put into the eye. It's like a little implant, and then it needs to be filled up intermittently every 6 months with the ranibizumab drug. And I mean, it is something obviously that has to go into the eye. It has to have a little mini operation to have that put in. It's used mainly for macular degeneration, not so much for diabetes, really. Macular degeneration, some patients have had this. There were a few problems initially with putting this implant in, but some patients seem to really like it, and it seems to work quite well. But it's still early days, and it hasn't really been adopted for diabetes really yet, although they are looking to move it into the diabetes side of things, because it has had some success in macular degeneration. It's still the same drug. It's still Lucentis that has to be injected into, put into it, filled up every 6 months or so. Gene therapy, it's quite exciting. I mean, it's still very, very early days, but some of the studies have looked at gene therapy, injecting a small amount of a gene under the retina with a micro injector to potentially provide a continuous supply of this anti-VEGF in treatment. So instead of having to have monthly injections, you might be able to put this little gene under the retina, and then it'll just stay there and produce anti-VEGF constantly in the eye. And it seems to be very well tolerated in the first 15 people in this trial. They looked at safety and looked at progression of diabetes, and it does seem to be working quite well, although it's still very early days and we still don't know enough about gene therapy, but it certainly is promising. The DIAMOND study also is a new study looking at this dexamethasone eye drop. It's basically a steroid eye drop that you put into the eye to see if it can help with diabetic maculopathy. I mean, it's still undergoing trials and they do look favourable, although it's difficult to know how long, you know, you might have to continue to use the drop forever. And the danger is that will it increase the pressure in the eye? Because we know steroids can cause cataract and can cause pressure rise. So whether that will be a problem in the future is yet to see. But that's a Swiss group looking at that. So in summary, you can have severe retinopathy at the back of your eye without any symptoms. That's why it's important to have a yearly diabetic check at your diabetic eye screening program or in your eye clinic if you're seeing the eye clinic. Just because you have retinopathy or maculopathy does not mean that you need to have treatment. Often observation and just improved glucose or blood pressure or cholesterol control is all that's required. But if you do need treatment, laser and injection treatments are very effective and they often work very well and are already available now with NICE approval. And very, very rarely surgery is needed. That's pretty rare to need an operation. But the operations can be very successful. Treatments are improving all the time and new trials are promising for drugs that last longer and can reduce the levels of retinopathy and maculopathy. Thank you. Happy to take any questions.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Samantha. Very, very informative as always. Lots of info. So thanks very much. So welcome, Jerry.
Hi.
Hi.
did we get anything through the chat, Jerry? I know we have one question from Bernie. But...
About macular ischemia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
You mentioned.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Please, can you explain what this is and is there any treatment planned for the future?
Okay, so yes, sorry, I didn't mention macular ischemia. Macular ischemia is effectively where the blood supply has failed at the very centre, at the back of the eye. And it usually is a result of having diabetes for a long time. Unfortunately, it doesn't have a treatment because at the moment there is no way of increasing the perfusion or the blood supply at the back of the eye. Once that has occurred, it generally means that there's not enough blood supply getting to that part of the very central part of the back of the eye. The cells are not able to get enough oxygen or nutrients, and that area of the retina cannot see. It's usually the very central part of the back of the eye, the macula, and as I said, even though all of the anti-VEGF trials and other trials have looked at trying to see if these treatments can increase the blood supply at the back of the eye, none of the treatments have been able to do that. So it's unfortunately a chronic side effect for patients. Some patients who have a very, almost like a very severe type of diabetes where they just have the blood supply is a problem. And, you know, unfortunately not treatable at this stage. But it doesn't just happen in diabetes, it does also happen in vein occlusions. Some patients have blockages of veins at the back of the eye, and that causes a severe reduction in blood supply as well. But you can't predict who gets the ischemia and who doesn't. And, you know, sometimes it happens, you know, later on in the disease process, sometimes it happens early on, but you can't really predict who's going to get the maculopathy, the macular ischemia, and who isn't.
Thank you. Another question is, can you have retinopathy and not have maculopathy and vice versa? And can you have both?
Yes, so you can definitely have both. In fact, most patients have both. You can have retinopathy and no maculopathy. So that's also quite common. A lot of our type 1 patients have retinopathy. So they can get R1 level or R2 level or R3 level, and you can get no maculopathy at all. So that's quite common, particularly in type 1 patients. You can't get it the other way around. So you can't have maculopathy and no retinopathy, because as soon as you have any degree of maculopathy, you've automatically got retinopathy as well. So you can't have maculopathy and no retinopathy, but you can have it the other way around.
Thank you. I've got one or two. Did I miss it, or did you mention brolucizumab, Beovu?
Oh, so no, you're right. I didn't mention Beovu. Brolucizumab is another drug that is available, and it is certainly has been used in age-related macular degeneration. We have concerns about Beovu just because with the macular degeneration studies, there were cases, not many, but there were a few cases of what we call vasculitis, where there was, it was called an occlusive vasculitis, where there was a very severe loss of vision from a very severe inflammatory process at the back of the eye. And it wasn't many cases, but the American Academy did put out a warning about the Beovu when it was first released for macular degeneration. And so we're very, very cautious about using Beovu just for concern. I mean, it's only likely to be very small amounts of cases, but the risk of severe sight loss with this retinal vasculitis could be severe. And we're just a little bit nervous about using it. So we haven't used it. Certainly in our centre, but some places are using it because it does last longer than the current aflibercept and Lucentis. But with the faricimab coming through, there have been no reports of the vasculitis from the. But I agree, we haven't used it very much yet. But there haven't been any reports of the occlusive vasculitis with the Vabysmo and the faricimab. So we're just keener to use that one because it might mean the patients can get to 3 or 4 months between the injections rather than 1 to 2 months that we're getting at the moment.
Thank you. Yes, that's been my general impression. Faricimab was probably going to outcompete brolucizumab.
Yeah, I think.
Thank you. I suppose it strikes me that there's a lot of types of treatment for this condition and lots of options, I suppose. How do the ophthalmologists decide above and beyond NICE guidance and things like that, how to treat a person? Is it very much experience or is there guidance? Or
yeah, I mean it does come from experience, but there's guidance. I mean the Royal College has published a really good diabetic retinopathy protocol recently, but it does depend on very much on what the combination of signs are. So if we see lots of retinopathy and lots of maculopathy, then we would probably prefer to use a combination of laser and anti-VEGF injections. If you just see predominantly the maculopathy, the first line is always the anti-VEGF treatments because they seem to be the most effective. And then there are some patients that can't have the anti-VEGFs, or if we're worried about them not being able to attend on a monthly basis, or they have a very high risk of had a recent heart attack or recent stroke, we wouldn't normally start someone on an anti-VEGF treatment. We would want to use a steroid one instead. So there are certain rules that we follow to decide which treatment is the best to go for. But a lot of patients need a combination of treatments. As you said, there's lots of treatments out there, and sometimes a combination works better. But laser and a bit of laser and a bit of injection and a bit of steroid sometimes if someone's going away for 3 months holiday and then they have a steroid one instead. So it does vary according to the patient.
Thank you. Another question's just come in. Some people have antibiotic eye drops to use after injections and some are not given them. Why would that be, please?
Oh, that's a good question. So we used to use antibiotic drops a lot with all our patients, but actually the evidence base has shown that it doesn't reduce the risk of endophthalmitis. So we worry, the reason why we give antibiotics is because we worry about infection, and in endophthalmitis is a severe infection that you can get after an injection. It is rare, it's like 1 in 1,000 cases, but if it does happen, it can affect the vision permanently. So we always worry about it. But the evidence base showed that the antibiotics did not prevent endophthalmitis. And it actually caused more increased resistance to the antibiotic. And it was actually the college that recommended that they were no longer given out. The Royal College suggested it no longer given out routinely. So I think some centres do still use it. We've stopped using antibiotics now, and we've not shown any increased risk of our endophthalmitis rate. So for fear of causing increased resistance, and most patients just have just artificial teardrops are all that's needed to lubricate the eye. Rather than an actual antibiotic as such.
Thank you. One that refers to wet AMD, but some wet AMD patients don't benefit from anti-VEGF treatment after a few years. Mm. So I think that question is about the sort of becoming resistant to the drug.
Yeah.
Is that the same for maculopathy patients?
So definitely there is a feeling that you can get this, what's called tachyphylaxis, where you don't respond to the drug as much anymore. With maculopathy, with diabetes patients, certainly the patients I treat, I don't tend to keep them on treatment quite as long, because once the maculopathy has gone away with the anti-VEGF, I tend to stop the treatment and then restart it only if the patient gets a recurrence of the edema in the future. I think there's less evidence suggesting that the tachyphylaxis in diabetes. However, it is true that if you start a new drug, so the likelihood is if the aflibercept will stop working, then you're better off at changing over to a new drug. And it may be that faricimab or one of these other agents would be better, or changing tack completely and start using a steroid. So there is certainly some patients that stop responding to treatment or just don't respond full stop. So certainly some patients can have six injections of one treatment, doesn't really do anything, or the first injection might have worked and then after that nothing really changes. Then it's better, you're better off changing to a different medication and see another one might work better.
Thank you. And one that I've often wondered, because I've seen different advice from different hospitals on what you should do after you've had an injection. Mm. And this one, I've seen everything is quoted here, you shouldn't do your gardening, you shouldn't wash your hair. Mm-hmm. And it's been a bit confusing when different hospitals have said different things about what you should and shouldn't do after you've had an injection.
Yeah. I don't think there's any hard and fast rules. I think you just have to be very sensible. I mean, you don't want to obviously increase the risk of an infection. I mean, and so anything like gardening, you know, potentially could, you know, if you get a bit of dirt in your eye, you're potentially introducing bacteria or fungus into the eye, or I mean anything that I think if you're sensible, if you can wear protective eyewear, it's all hearsay, really. There's no fixed rules and there haven't been any particular guidance from the college or anything, but you know it probably does take about a week for the eye to recover completely from your injection, and you just want to be sensible not to get any nasty bug potentially in the eye.
I think it's usually swimming that you should really avoid. Yeah,
swimming particularly because of the there's bacteria and protozoa and all sort of things that live in swimming pools, so you just have to be a bit more careful. Yeah.
Lovely. Thank you for reminding us of that. And no other general questions, Colin.
Great. Okay. Well, perfect. Well, thank you very much. Well, that's been a really interesting talk again. So thank you very much for coming, Sam. Jerry, is there anything that you'd like to add?
This is the point where I usually talk about the chance to take part in clinical trials.
Yeah.
And to advertise the fact that we have what we call our research participant database. So that's a way that you can register with us that you might be interested in taking part in a clinical trial. But not just clinical trials. We're always being asked to support people who are carrying out other types of research like surveys. So a lot of people want to know about your views of being a patient and about your views of potential treatments and support. So do look out for adverts for that as well. We have a particular page on our website where we advertise surveys that people might want. It's another way of taking part in research, and it's really a valued way of doing it, not just being on a clinical trial. The patient voice is very important in research. So do look on our website for the research participant database.
Brilliant, thank you. Now, I need to tell you something, because if I don't, one of our fabulous volunteers, Bernie, will absolutely murder me. As again, we do have the Macular Society, excellently facilitated by Bernie, has a online, so virtual diabetic macular edema and retinopathy support group, which meets once a month at 7 p.m. over Zoom. So if you want any more information about that, either contact me directly through the Advice and Information Service, or just have a quick look on the Old Macular Society website, and the information on how to join is there. So there you go. I can live and breathe another day. That's marvellous. So it only leaves me just to thank Samantha Mann again. So thank you ever so much for joining us this evening and giving up some of your valuable time.